heard a lot about tiny houses as one of the solutions in the affordable housing crisis. Tiny houses are trending in communities from California to Kentucky. A tiny house is also featured as the home of a young couple in their parents' backyard on the TV show Life in Pieces. Soon, Kauai will have a model tiny house produced by the statewide Native Hawaiian nonprofit Homestead Housing Authority. I talk with Robin Poinani Danner, the chairman of the Sovereign Councils of the Hawaiian Homelands Assembly, about why the authority is investing in a tiny homes pilot project.
We saw it as a real solution to overcrowding situations with many families in Hawaii, and really a realistic, achievable option to increasing the affordable housing inventory in Hawaii. So that's really our focus, not on mobile or trendy statuses of the tiny home movement, but to use the thought process of tiny homes, which really aren't tiny. I mean, we're focused on a 480 square foot unit, which is, you know, a good size apartment, a studio apartment. And so we're trying it out and seeing if the tiny home creativity can be one small solution toward the housing crisis in Hawaii.
Prefabrication is usually what makes it affordable and easier to both ship and then erect. How is your home a little different, perhaps, than some of the ones that we've seen in some of the more well-publicized media?
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why we've been working on this concept and thinking about it and running numbers for about, 9 months to a year. And so what's coming up next month in June is we actually want to touch it, feel it, track every single cost related to it, track the number of labor hours that would be needed to erect it. So the prefabricated model has promise, but at the same time, we are comparing it to, as best we can, apples to apples as best we can, to a conventional stick-built home of similar size. What we're finding, again, we will be able to check the boxes on exact data in about a month. But what we're finding in our budgetary approaches is that a prefabricated unit will run maybe $20,000, $25,000 less with materials and labor and shipping and all of that calculated in. But the real value, I think, and again, we're in a part of this pilot is about proving out all these theories so that they aren't theories anymore. But the real value is in the cost savings in labor and the cost savings in time. You know that saying, time is money? It really does apply to home building. And so what we're finding is that we should be able to enclose a prefabricated unit, you know, inside of a week, whereas if we were using conventional stick build, it would be a couple months.
The idea that time is money is certainly something that most people who've gone through either a build from scratch or have done remodeling understand. When you say that, you know, you're going to be able to build this in under a week, we're not going to see things, I would imagine, like, you know, tiny Tudors or itty-bitty ranch houses or some of the more colorful styles that have made their way into our consciousness over the last several years that tiny homes have become a real trending item.
No, I don't. That's not the direction we're headed in. As I said, the tiny home movement has come in all shapes and sizes, and some of it is fad related. We tried to take the best of the creativity and the core thought process around tiny homes for a permanent structure. So you'll see the unit that we're piloting to come in first is 20 by 24. So that's a pretty standard and very similar to conventional stick-built packages, 20 by 24 equaling 480 square feet. It'll have a one-bedroom, one-bath with stackable washer-dryer, a full kitchen, and, of course, a small living area. So it's not going to be colorful or cartoonish or carnivalistic. It's really the solution we want to bring in is a real conventional living quarters that maybe kupuna, who might have been overcrowded in their original home by older children or grown adult children, all overcrowded in the same home, and they can place a tiny home on the same lot. Or maybe it's for young adults that have grown up in a house and are starting out. So there's a specific demographic that I think these apartment-style homes will fit a need.
Because there is such a concern about aesthetics for neighborhoods and just in general, can you describe what style these houses are in? What would you call it?
They're pretty conventional. I mean, it'll have a gabled roof for example. And again, I think June 20th, and by the end of June, you know, by July 1st, we're going to have a real live touch it, feel it, walk through it opportunity, which is why our nonprofit felt that it was powerful and important to dedicate resources to doing a pilot for ourselves first before we made any of these units available to our friends and family and community.
At what point do you think you'll make them available?
After the pilot is done in the end of June, and if it meets muster, if it meets our standards and we're happy with it, we could end up opening to take orders by the end of July.
But those orders would be replications of the one that they're seeing. You're not going to allow people to change things a little bit and try to make it a little more personal?
What a great question. We have three specific designs right now. We have a 16 by 20, which is 320 square feet that we're looking at. That's the smallest. Then a 20 by 20, which is 400 square feet. And the largest unit that we're committed to right now is a 20 by 24, the 480 square feet, which is the pilot that's coming in. So we want to make some basic variations available. And then through this learning process, through this first pilot unit, we'll be able to know what other kinds of alterations that wouldn't get too complicated. And again, alterations create cost, right? So we want to be right in the swim lane that keeps this thing under $75,000, under, you know, $500 a month with ownership in 13 to 15 years. So we've got a specific target that we're trying to meet. And if changes stay within that target, okay. If not, then we're probably going to lay down on three or four very basic plans.
After you go through this pilot program on Kauai, is there already a plan to be able to move this through the rest of Hawaii?
Yes. The Board of Commissioners of our nonprofit, our Homestead Housing Authority, was very deliberate a year ago when we decided to prove out this concept up or down. They wanted to start on a neighbor island because a lot of initiatives get started on Oahu. And so we're starting on Kauai. And then, like I said, if later in the fall, if things work out well and the board is happy and the nonprofit's happy with the product, then we'll make it available to other islands for sure.
Well, we'll look forward to getting a picture of it as soon as it's built in about a month. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Bethany. You have a great day.
Robin Puanani Danner is the chairman of the Sovereign Councils of the Hawaiian Homelands Assembly. The Homestead Housing Authority is running the pilot project. It's a statewide nonprofit that's governed by Native Hawaiians to develop affordable housing, community facilities, and to foster economic development on or near Hawaiian homelands.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide member support at Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, remembering the music of the silent movies, but first, your quiz.
Since we'll be looking at the world of silent film in our next segment, today's Backyard Quiz concerns a film-focused event that's become an integral part of the fall season in Hawaii, the Hawaii International Film Festival, often referred to as HIFF. It's become the world's leading event for showcasing Asian and Pacific Island films in the U.S. Among the films that have had a world premiere at HIFF are A Leading Man, Once We're Warriors, The Piano, Shine, Shall We Dance, and Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. It's the only film festival that presents the films across the state, with screenings on Oahu, Maui, Kauai, and Hawaii Island. It's likely to thrive for many more years, but right now we're wondering if anyone can tell us the year the Hawaii International Film Festival first came to local movie screens. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And if you're first and right, you get the prize.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
The term silent movie is kind of a misnomer. Nobody watched them in silence. Music played live in the theater was an essential part of the experience. The movies were accompanied by some of the most original popular music of the early 20th century. But like silent cinema itself, the art of creating movie music before the advent of talkies is one that was too quickly abandoned and is too little known of today. Conductor Rick Benjamin, who is conducting the Hawaii Chamber Orchestra in a program of classic silence tomorrow, has made it his mission to keep silent movie music alive, and he's with us in our studio. Rick, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Great to be here.
What was the experience of going to a movie theater and watching a silent like?
Well, it was much more of a world of sound than people would imagine today, because obviously the pictures couldn't deliver their own dialogue. So the music had to not just transmit the missing elements, in other words, project the mood, but it also had a whole bunch of other kinds of features aside from accompanying the pictures. Music was used in very elaborate ways by itself to set the mood as people walked into the theater during real change. And during all kinds of segments. There was a whole presentational style that that evolved around this art form that is completely lost. And that's one of the things that when I'm working with orchestras like Chamber Music Hawaii, we try to bring back.
Who was creating this music?
Well, there were a couple of hundred composers starting to work in this field, starting in the early 1900s. To start off, first of all, the idea of moving pictures in the 1800s was such a tremendously exciting thing that for a long time, the films didn't use sound. But they were also short. They might be 30 seconds long. But someone finally got the idea that you could actually use the same musicians who were playing for live shows in these theaters to play for the pictures. And so this art form was born about 1900. But there was a whole bunch of folks who were tremendously gifted, whose names have vanished now to most audiences, or actually every audience, people like Mayhew Lake, who composed the first complete film score in 1899.
Let's hear a couple of recorded examples of here's some music that we would hear for in a major key to accompany a love scene.
And this, in fact, is by Mr. Lake.
All right. That all is well in paradise with our lovers.
Oh, absolutely.
But now now something intrudes and there's a sudden wrinkle, right? Oh, yeah, there you go. So we now hear the same motif basically in a major, in a minor key.
That's correct.
That
yeah.
we've heard in a major key.
Right, and then without any spoken dialogue from our actors or actresses on the screen, without
even
an intertitle,
we know romance is in trouble.
We know what's happening. Or there's a scheme going on behind the scenes or something.
Somebody's trying to steal Daisy's heart away or something
exactly.
like that. Yeah.
And something must be done about this right now.
Tomorrow you are performing the music of the music that goes with the movies of three of the greatest filmmakers. It almost seems limiting to call Chaplin and Keaton and Harold Lloyd the greatest silent filmmakers. Mm-hmm. They're among the greatest filmmakers to me.
Yeah, I think that's a true statement. Tomorrow's program is dedicated to comedy, and what's really exciting about it is that we'll be performing the three original scores for these films mm-hmm. that were issued at the time the films were brand new. So you'll get to see Buster Keaton in the Playhouse with the 1921 compilation score, and Harold Lloyd in Never Weaken, one of his thrill comedies, with the original score. And then the finale is Charlie Chaplin in Easy Street, his sort of social commentary from 1916 with the original orchestral score for that from that year.
When he was sort of beginning to introduce that whole that element of sadness to his comedy that became so much a part
pathos,
of it later on.
Yeah, was very, very important. And he was a wide-ranging actor. Chaplin, of course, came from the British music hall tradition.
Yeah.
So his artistry, his pantomime especially, is exquisite. It really is just beautiful to watch it.
Well, it really was a golden age. And so let's say that this Chaplin film were being shown in Des Moines at a theater, and there's a mm-hmm. there's a band in the theater. What when the film can arise, what? There's sheet music to go with it?
Yeah, well, to just even back up a little bit further, by 1916, there were more than 20,000 movie theaters in the U.S.
Wow.
And all of them had to have a staff of musicians because of the films, as we've discussed, didn't have any sound. In small places, a Nickelodeon, as they were called, you might have a pianist, mm-hmm. Perhaps a drummer, too, or a violinist.
Mm-hmm.
But by 1913 or 14, the standard to be met was to have a small orchestra, and 11 instruments was the minimum.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of your management of a theater, you not only had a projector and a screen and seats and a ticket booth, but you had a sheet music library. And you'd have 2,000 or 3,000 standard pieces of music.
Like the things we just heard.
Exactly.
Major love theme, minor love theme.
Exactly. You'd have 2,000 or 3,000 of those covering every possible human situation or emotion. Volcanic eruption, submarine attack, love scene, comic chase scene.
Train wreck. Yeah.
Exactly. Every one of these things all filed in your music library by mood or situation.
Yeah.
And then correspondingly out in the West Coast, you would have the film studio, when they finished the cut of their new movie, would have their resident musical expert watch it with mm-hmm. a stopwatch and a stenographer taking notes and then recommending what of each of these standard pieces that everyone already had should be used for each scene of the movie.
Uh-huh.
And this would be typed up and sort of mimeographed into thousands of copies called the musical setting, 4-page brochure.
Uh-huh.
And that would be tucked into the cans of film that were sent out from the studio to all of the thousands of exchanges across the country. And when that arrived on Monday morning, Sparky would grab the can of film and run up to the projection booth, and he would hand me, the musical director, the musical setting, and I would go down into the library and begin to assemble the setting. That's what they called it. So, yes, the first scene might be Love Music by Lake or whatever. Put together this composite score, and then we would rehearse it quickly and then perform it that night, and people would be enthralled.
You know, Rick, movies are praised for being this immersive experience, but today's immersive experience has got nothing on that to me.
I think you're right. Live music.
And,
yeah, there really is nothing like the live experience. For one thing, I mean, even with advances in the reproduction of sound, recorded sound is very advanced, but they still have not been able to capture the actual changes in air pressure that occur when real people are playing
that's
instruments.
That's a good way to describe it.
And silent cinema especially is something that can really only be experienced in a theater with other people.
Well, we've got a rare opportunity to do that. Thanks a lot, Rick.
Great pleasure.
Rick Benjamin is the founder and conductor of the Paragon Orchestra, which specializes in early 20th century popular music. Movies shown this weekend are Charlie Chaplin's Easy Street, Buster Keaton's The Playhouse, and Harold Lloyd's Never Weaken. The show is in Orvis Auditorium on the Manoa campus tomorrow at 7:30. Thank you.
One of the things that we do on a Friday is to take a look at what's brewing in our news department. And to help us with that preview, Bill Dorman, HBR's news director, joins us now. What's happening?
Aloha, Beth Ann. Sometimes some surprises and sometimes other developments going on. Starting off for next week, some news from one of our neighbor islands on Maui. You know, Baldwin Beach Park, about 17 acres on the North Shore outside Paia. And there's a homeless population there that has been expanded quite a bit over time. Now, county officials are going to be doing a sweep there on Tuesday. But ahead of that, Colleen Uechi of the Maui News is going to take a closer look at the situation there, sort of how that got to be, a little bit of what that is, and what county officials know about who comprises that group. So that's going to be ahead of that sweep next week.
I take it going out there and just talking to some of these people and finding out a lot more about who they are and giving some insight.
Exactly. And, you know, that's those individual stories so much in terms of various aspects of the homeless story and situation across the state. Another part of that, homeless veterans, you know, the point in time count that was recently conducted across the island showed that on Oahu, the number of homeless veterans was up 9%. There is an annual program, Vet Aid, which actually is taking place over this weekend on Saturday. And Wayne Yoshioka, one of our own vets on staff, is going to go down and talk to some of the folks, take a look not just at some of the support services that are there, but also some of the peer support in addition to the service providers, and get a little bit more, you know, context and perspective on that, really.
And peer-to-peer is very often the way some of that better context happens.
It's true.
What else we have happening in arts and culture?
Arts and culture, always something going on. Maui Arts Month continues, and the movement, really it's an ongoing story, highlighting Native Hawaiian arts and artists and cultural practitioners. Noe Tanigao has been doing a lot with this throughout the month of May, and continuing this coming week, a couple of profiles and portraits and soundscapes on artists helping to make this up. So that'll be good to look forward to next week as well.
All right, you have one more small opportunity. Anything else that you need to tell us or you want to tell us?
A lot going on, and we'll keep you posted on a number of fronts.
All right, stay tuned.
You bet.
Thanks very much. Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. Hawaii's legislative leadership is now in place. Newly elected House Speaker Scott Saiki calls the team the face of Hawaii. With more of what that face looks like, Civil Beat reporter Nathan Eagle has today's reality check. Hey there.
Hey, how's it going?
All right, thanks. Now, we knew that Scott Saiki was voted in. Now we also know what his leaders are all about. Interesting, there's not only new people in post, but an additional post. Why do we have two policy leaders now?
Well, part of it is he wants to get the younger members more of an opportunity. He also wants to have better neighbor island representation. So that's why he's trying to do this tag team.
Tag team of in that way only? I mean, it seems like we've got a real wide swath here of people who are in various different generations and also with, you know, different perspectives.
Absolutely. He's not just doing the two policy leaders for the first time, but there's also five majority whips with Representatives Henry Aquino, Aaron Ling Johansson, Chris Lee, Mark Nakashima, and Justin Woodson. They're coming from parts of Maui, Big Island, Oahu, and they're replacing the one majority whip that was prior to that change, Representative Ken Ito, who was from Oahu.
Interesting that you mentioned Aaron Ling Johansson. I mean, only a couple of years ago, he was a Republican.
Exactly. I asked Scott Sikey that question, and he told me that he feels comfortable with him serving in a leadership post. He said that he's contributed to the Democratic caucus in a substantive manner, quote.
In looking at the lineup of people who now are the leadership positions, seeing one face that most people might expect would be in that, Della Albalotti.
Absolutely. The former, current health committee chair is now going to be the vice speaker. Scott Sikey told me that he wanted to have his top lieutenants be all female, which is, I think, a first. And so he's got her in the top post as vice speaker and calls her intelligent, hardworking, and vision. So he's really excited to have her on board.
And the other women?
Representative Dee Morikawa, she's from Kauai, and Representative Cindy Evans from over on the Big Island.
So in general, when you look at this lineup of folks, what are you taking away from it that might somehow set us up for what may happen either later this summer or the next legislative session?
Well, what I'm seeing is it's bigger, noticeably. There's a few extra positions. It's younger, and some of those younger members tend to be a lot more progressive. And then it's more diverse as well. So you've got, I think by my last count, 11 members of the 51 that are part of leadership. So we'll see how that changes and how that affects things.
And what difference they're able to make. Thanks very much. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org, today featuring reporter Nathan Eagle. Another Friday thing we do is to read your letters and emails and posts. After my interview with retired Air Force General Dan Leaf on North Korea and missile defense, Gus Costa from Hawaii Island called our talkback line and said this.
Good morning, gang. Gus Costa here from the Big Island. I'm seeing you're feeling sort of targeted by North Korea, and you have to wonder, where do they get all the trigger mechanisms and the all guidance systems and the metal and the gunpowder and all the stuff to make a nuclear missile? You wonder, you know, is that England, China, United States, Australia? Who's doing that?
Well, we called General Leaf to get an answer for Gus, and here's what he said.
Gus, that's a great and complicated question. North Korea has shown a remarkable ability to, despite their limited circumstances, and limited circumstances understates their condition, to get material for nuclear and missile development from a variety of sources, develop some internally, put together some from sources in perhaps the former Soviet Union. There are allegations that some comes from Pakistan, some from Iran, but put it all together with what they can develop on their own and develop real capability. They've done the same thing, apparently, in the cyber realm. So despite their abject poverty, we shouldn't underestimate North Korea's ability to put the things they need together to build nuclear capability, missile technology, and even cyber warfare.
And this email came from Cheryl Lynch following yesterday's Town Square program on the nexus of substance abuse and mental health. Quote, as a family member, I find it very difficult to tell the difference between what is mental health related behavior and what are behaviors created by drug use or the after effects of drugs. The drug user slash mental health sufferer has all the rights, and no one has any rights to address this behavior if the user suffered doesn't want the help. And they are causing problems for themselves and the public and their families and the police.
Alan Schofer on Maui sent us this via email. It seems to me that a large part of potential health care is left out, using acupuncture and traditional Chinese medicinal herbs to treat patients. I'm an acupuncturist on the island of Maui. I treat vets and many other patients with pain, addictions, depression, and other ailments, and see great improvement on non-narcotic, non-addictive herbal treatments and acupuncture.
Thanks for the feedback. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line, 808-792-8217.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, now accepting applications for summer school featuring camps on drone photography and filmmaking for girls and boys in preschool through grade 12. SacredHearts.org.
At the end of the legislative session, House lawmakers surprised seemingly everyone by advancing the idea that the rail shortfall should come from an expanded transit accommodations tax. Continuing our county check-ins, we called the chair of the county at the heart of the row, Honolulu's Ron Manor, for his take on the session's cliffhanger end.
Well, I think it could have been better, especially with respect to the rail issue. I spent a lot of time with the mayor and other city officials trying to persuade the legislature that it was important for them to approve a funding mechanism that would generate sufficient revenue for the city to be able to complete rail to cover our shortfall. And we tried to emphasize the fact that we believe that the most reasonable, equitable, and logical funding mechanism would be to extend the excise tax surcharge, which did not happen, unfortunately. And the concern we have on the part of the city is that, really, given our tight budgetary situation, city officials do not believe that any portion or aspect of the rail construction costs should be covered with city revenues, and more specifically with real property tax revenues. But, you know, unfortunately, the issue was not resolved. Nevertheless, I remain optimistic. Having been a former state legislator, I've been through extended and special sessions in the past, and I know that there are times when legislators are faced with very difficult and challenging issues, and they just need more time to get them resolved.
And how much of the shakeup in the legislature do you think will play into having a special session and being able to resolve the issue?
I don't have any doubt that there will be a special session. In fact, both Senate and House leaders have indicated that a special session is in order. The new House Speaker has indicated as such, and I've heard through the grapevine in terms of his discussions with other legislators that he understands that the real issue is an important issue for the state legislature to resolve, that it's not an issue that they can go into the next election year not coming up with adequate solutions. So I'm very confident that they will go back into special session in the coming weeks.
How much of a probability statement would you put to the idea of having the GET extended a little bit, perhaps even the TAT, and also having property taxes as part of that portfolio of fundraising?
Well, there is a possibility that at the end of the day, following a special session, that the legislature may approve a combination of funding mechanisms, and it could include the TAT. As far as real property taxes are concerned, I'm totally opposed to that. Council members would have serious concerns about tapping into real property tax revenue. So we're very sensitive to the fact that our residents on this island are already having to cope with a high real estate cost. In addition, we have a tight budgetary situation. You know, we're currently trying to wrap up our city budget and trying to provide the necessary core services and public safety while at the same time balancing our budget. The city budget is already tight. There would be major concerns about increasing real property taxes. So I'm still hopeful that in terms of what the legislature approves, that it will not force the city to have to consider utilizing real property taxes to fund rail construction.
I know our time is short. I want to ask you about homelessness. We saw the point in time count come out, and there were some very nice numbers for Oahu that are now really being challenged by some who have been involved with the point in time count for a very long time. What is it that you take away from both the point-in-time count, the numbers of homeless people that we seem to still see in great magnitude in certain places around the city, and the fact that maybe this point-in-time count was not as consistent with the way it has been done in past?
Well, I'm not so sure about the methodology, and I really can't comment on the extent to which the figures were accurate. All I can say is that I'm hopeful that we have seen improvement. And if there has been improvement and the numbers bear that out, I think it's because there has been a concerted effort on both the state and city levels to really try to tackle and address the issue more proactively and more effectively. For example, on the city level, the city council has approved millions of dollars to fund programs and services that benefit the homeless. We've provided more monies for temporary shelters. We've provided monies for housing first accommodations that the mayor and his administration has been implementing in terms of providing permanent supportive housing, which really is a long-term solution to homelessness. We've provided more monies for outreach services and the provision of services that the chronically homeless need in order to be able to get them off the streets.
What is that you would like to see happen as a next step for being able to counter homelessness in Oahu?
You know, I've always believed, and I've come to the understanding that resolving homelessness is a complex issue and there is no silver bullet, that it takes a multifaceted approach. In terms of a multi-pronged approach, I think we need to continue to put more resources to outreach services. I think we need to continue developing more shelters. But what we really have a need is for long-term permanent supportive housing. That, I believe, that area of housing, I believe, is in short supply. We also need to do more with respect to affordable housing, and in particular, affordable rentals, because the fact is many people are homeless because they can't afford the high rents that they have to pay in the market. So I think state and city government ultimately need to be more proactive and more effective in addressing our affordable housing crisis.
And how exactly would you see that be different this time? Because what you've just said, we could have had a conversation several years ago where you could have said the exact same thing, and people have been hearing this now over and over again. Is there something that you've identified that you think the city should be doing that it has yet to be able to accomplish?
Well, you know, again, I'm a believer in permanent supportive housing based on the Housing First model that has worked successfully in other jurisdictions. And I wanted to see these programs get off the ground, but they finally are happening. The mayor, for example, has announced a number of projects that will incorporate the Housing First model. I'm anxiously looking forward to the opening of the Ivale facility that's going to provide permanent supportive housing together with services, and also will provide a hygiene center. So I think that the monies that we've appropriated, the administration is now, you know, spending and implementing successfully, and I'm looking forward to seeing more of these kinds of Housing First projects implemented on this island in the future. I think another area with a tremendous amount of potential, and we are making some progress on that, is our ADU, or Accessory Dwelling Unit Program, which I helped to establish through a resolution I introduced several years ago. And we've been working with the mayor to provide incentives for more people to develop or create these ADUs, which can be rented as affordable rentals, and we're seeing the numbers go up in terms of the development of these ADUs. So more needs to be done, but I think that we're moving in the right direction. And finally, the city will be adopting an affordable housing policy. You know, the mayor unveiled his proposal several weeks ago, and very shortly he plans to introduce a bill that's going to specify affordable housing requirements for new major developments on this island. The city council is also considering a bill to impose affordable housing requirements on developers in TOD areas. And by the way, that's one of the reasons why I support RAIL, because of the TOD affordable housing opportunities that the project could present in the future. So we have a long ways to go, but I think we are making progress in addressing these issues.
And just finally, before I let you go, when we talk about affordable, we never really talk about putting, you know, some dollar amounts to that. Some people who have ADUs are renting them for $1,500 a month, $1,800 a month. That doesn't sound very affordable to someone who is living at the very low end of the economic spectrum. Is there a way that you think that there should be some sort of control over that, that if you have an ADU or if you have affordable housing, that it would be based on really what people are able to handle, not necessarily an area median income or other ways in which we've been figuring it in past?
Well, you know, in passing the ADU law, you know, the council did impose requirements that are intended to try to ensure that more of these units would be rented at affordable levels, that people who are struggling to afford being able to pay rents can afford in the future. So, for example, we have strict limits on the maximum size of an ADU unit. And we also make sure that the rental agreement must be for at least 6 months. But given the size limitations, the thinking is that as more of these ADUs are developed, it's going to have to be rented to people who have very limited income means. That is something that we are going to be monitoring down the road. But again, you know, in addressing affordable housing, it takes a partnership. And in terms of developing more of these rentals for people at the low income levels, developers need state affordable housing assistance, and that's where the state legislature has been helpful and needs to be more helpful in the future.
I'm curious about your comment when you said that you'll be monitoring in the future what the ADUs are being rented for. How would you do that?
Well, you know, the City Department of Planning and Permitting is maintaining a list and inventory of all of the ADU applications that come in and that are approved. And so based on that inventory, I believe that they'll be able to do some monitoring in the future to determine to what extent the development of these ADUs are helping to address our affordable housing issue. That's an evaluation that's got to be happening down the road if we are to get a better understanding and to be assured that this program is, in fact, providing affordable rentals for the residents of this island.
We'll look forward to seeing that. Thank you so much for your time today, Ron Manor.
Okay. Thank you for your questions.
Ron Manor is chair of the Honolulu City Council.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we got to thinking about a local cultural event that has put Hawaii on the world cinema map. The Hawaii International Film Festival was conceived as a bridge between East and West and has brought hundreds of Asian and Pacific Island films to the screen that might easily have gone unseen by U.S. audiences. Film critic Roger Ebert was a regular participant, and international movie stars like Maggie Cheung, Samuel L. Jackson, Sonny Chiba, and Ken Watanabe have come to Hawaii to be given acting awards. The festival has grown each year and has done much to encourage and support local filmmakers. Its roster includes shorts and documentaries, along with feature films from dozens of countries. We asked you what year it all began, and the answer to that is 1981.
And we heard from Andy Schwartz, who called us from Honolulu, knew the answer, and will be receiving the prize. If you've got a backyard quiz question for us, you can always send it in to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, partnering with parents and educators in Hawaii to strengthen the connection between school and home with tools to help monitor students' gains. Achieve3000.com. Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrew Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
Few musicians anywhere work as hard or cover as wide a variety of material as the members of military bands. The bands are expected to perform a wide variety of ceremonial and community outreach functions for both military and civilian audiences. Each branch of the service has its own musicians, and once a year, local audiences get an opportunity to hear them all together in the annual combined military band concert. Each year, a different conductor is given the task of pulling all that sound together, and this year, Marine Chief Warrant Officer 3 Brian Sherlock will do the honors. The concert's tomorrow in downtown Honolulu. Final rehearsals are underway, and Brian's with us by phone. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Chris. Pleasure to talk to you again. It's really nice that you're having me on the show.
You keeping busy?
Well, you know, in fact, I'm sitting in the lobby right now of the historic Hawaii Theater as we get ready for our final dress rehearsal for this concert that happens tomorrow night.
How many musicians have you had to corral for this thing?
Well, we won't have all of them on stage at any one time, but I think we're looking at about 60 total. I tell you, it's a concert that has to be seen as much as heard. As you mentioned, you get musicians in their full dress uniforms from all the services, all on stage together, and it's quite a sight as well as a great sound.
You know, I know that the folks in your band, the Marine Forces Pacific Band, are well attuned to you up there conducting the band. You know, you work with them all the time, but now you're introducing a great many new musicians, merging them with your folks. Yeah.
Oh, that's exactly right. Well, and they're also going to have at least four different conductors as well. So You know, music is the international language. We managed to fit it together really well. But the really special thing about military musicians is that we all kind of, if we don't know each other personally, we know of each other. It's a really, really small world. Mm-hmm. And many of us have crossed paths in the past. Many of us know each other from the Armed Forces School of Music as well. So a lot of times this concert is as fun for us as it will be for the audience. It's like a big family reunion for us.
Well, you know, Brian, you talk about the world of the military musician, and I'm not sure too many people in the civilian side really understand what that's like. But it starts, as it did for you, with a great deal of schooling, right?
Well, that's exactly right. So, as I mentioned, there's one Armed Forces school for music, and regardless of the service, once a person is recruited and has attended their basic training, we all kind of pass through that great institution at some time or another, many times for some of us.
Mm-hmm. And that you might recruited, say, if you were played trumpet in high school, and you might arrange through, what, an audition process to become a military musician?
Oh, that's exactly correct, yes. It's a lot like symphony musicians. We have to go through an audition process. The big difference being, of course, we also have to go to basic training and learn to carry a weapon and fight and use that weapon as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the day-to-day business of a military musician is music. And, you know, each of the service bands here on Oahu, they have a different mission. But as you mentioned in the intro there, it ultimately is about community outreach. There's a ceremonial portion as well. But, again, the great thing about this concert is it's an opportunity for all of us to show our appreciation to the community here.
Sure.
And really present a bang-up concert for anybody that's wanting to come out and hear something special.
Well, the demands that are placed on your musicians, Brian, involve maybe playing at a, you know, in a marching band environment to a symphony concert, maybe even in the same day, yeah?
No, that's exactly right. In fact, I think we've got several folks that are going to be running in last minute for this rehearsal that are out doing other ceremonial duties. So it's you know, you have to wear many hats, so to speak. You got to be very versatile, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. You've got how many over at in your Marine Forces Pacific Band? You've got what, about 60 people?
Actually, I have 50 over at Kaneohe Bay.
Mm-hmm.
We've got folks representing the 25th Infantry Division from Schofield Barracks. I think there's about 35 up there.
Mm-hmm.
We've got folks from the Pearl Harbor Band, the Navy Band over at Pearl Harbor. They've got about 30 or 35. We've got folks from the Air Force Band over at Hickam. I think they're about 15, so the smallest of the bands on island.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got friends from the Hawaii National Guard Band as well that are joining us for this. And they've got about 40, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
So ordinarily, as you alluded to earlier, Brian, you'd be playing in parallel to each other, right? You'd be doing different events on the same day. So it really isn't, what is it, just once a year that you get to get together with your colleagues?
Oh, absolutely. Once a year, and it's really special to us. I think it should be really special for the audience. Like you say, we've all got different missions. You know, we're all busy. Believe it or not, that many bands on one island, but because of our commands, there's quite a different mission for each band.
Mm-hmm.
This one week a year, we're able to, you know, carve out time from our schedules and put this together in a relatively short period of time. You know, you've got some of the best musicians from each of these bands. It really is. It's going to be the best concert this weekend.
What kind of music do you pick for a show like this, Brian?
Well, this was the first time. So this is our 32nd annual event here. And but the first time, to my knowledge, we're going to actually open up the concert with a good old-fashioned big band. So Glenn Miller, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, all that kind of stuff. So it, kind of with a nod to the 75th anniversary of the U.S. entrance into World War II.
Mm-hmm.
That jazz band is just kicking. It's going to be outstanding. That'll be the first half of the concert. And the second half of the concert, we'll go back to a more traditional symphonic setting, mm-hmm. where you're going to hear some patriotic music, some film music, some music that'll really tug at your heartstrings as well.
And that's with that's probably with your largest ensemble, I would think.
Yes, correct. So that group's got about 55 in it right now. So
mm-hmm.
Just actually, it's just right for the music that we've chosen. It's full depth in all the sections, great musicians from top to bottom.
There's nothing like the sound of that many musicians, and I've heard it, as you know, the sound of that many musicians on stage, you know, kind of all on the same page. It's got to be exciting for you as a conductor, Brian.
Oh, absolutely. This is one of those great opportunities. Yeah, you get, you wave your hands, and the sound that comes back at you is just, it's the reason we joined this whole profession to begin with, you know?
I bet. Well, thanks very much. It sounds like an exciting show, and I wish you luck with it. Good to talk to you, Brian.
Well, just so everybody's clear, it's the Hawaii Theater, 6:30 tomorrow evening. It's open to the public. It's free. There are tickets available. Ticket holders will get first choice of seats, but anybody that wants to come over at 6:30 tomorrow night is welcome to come in. For the folks that can't make it into the Hawaii Theater tomorrow evening, we're actually doing something else new this year, in that we're going to be streaming the concert live.
So, I'll look for that. Thanks a lot, Brian. That's Chief Warrant Officer 3 Brian Sherlock. He's the conductor for the 32nd Annual Combined Military Band Concert. And as he said, that's tomorrow at the Hawaii Theater in downtown Honolulu. Free and open to the public. Seating begins at 6:15. Concert begins at 7 p.m.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ekahi Ornish Lifestyle Medicine, Hawaii Pacific University, and Ulupono Initiative.
Well, that's going to bring us to the end of this week, and we thank you very much for spending time with us and hope you'll come back next week. And on Monday, we're going to find out why one research fellow at the Foundation for Government Accountability says that pointing a finger at Airbnb isn't the way to help Hawaii's affordable housing crisis.
And singer Rachel Gonzalez performs live in our studio and looks ahead to her Atherton concert.
In the meantime, if you'd like to be in touch, you've got lots of ways. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or tweet me at BKOZHPR.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information, go to The Conversation page on the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Amber Kahn are our production assistants. And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello.
I'm Chris Vanderbilt.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. See you next week for The Conversation.